Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. Delighted to welcome you to episode 2480 of The Tom Woods Show with my old Harvard professor, Vladimir Brovkin, who taught me 20th century Russian history all those years ago back in 1993. And we're going to talk in particular about a small section of his brand new book, which you can see right here, which is From Vladimir Lenin to Vladimir Putin, Russia in Search of Its Identity, 1913 to 2023. I read his book, The Mensheviks After October, because it was assigned in the course, and I'm a good student. And I remember his course. I mean, I beg your pardon for not letting you say hello yet, but I just need people to know. I invited my girlfriend, who was also a member of the Harvard class of 94, to one of his lectures because I said to her, you're not going to believe how interesting this guy is. So, Dr. Brovkin, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm very glad to see you. This is amazing, fantastic opportunity. And I'm just really amazed that you remember so many years later, not just that I taught this course, but what exactly I said. You quoted me what I said about the Russian Civil War. So that's amazing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, so Dr. Brovkin and I have been corresponding through email, and I do very distinctly, because a lot of times, how many things do you remember distinctly from your college courses? But in this case, but I will say one quick thing. So Harvard had something called the Course Evaluation Guide, and it was a compilation of what students had written at the end of the semester, and they grade the professors in various ways. And then they have a free response section where they can write whatever they want. Well, I was one of the editors of that one year before I took your course. And a few of the students, not enough to justify inclusion in the guide, but a handful of students criticized you for being too anti-Soviet. I don't know if you ever knew that, but a few students
complained. Yes, I know that. Yes.
It's just crazy.
Yes, I know.
Absolutely crazy.
Harvard was very liberal in those days, and this is one of the complaints I had, yes.
Yeah, it's just crazy. And then Professor Alan Brinkley used to teach at Harvard, then he went on to Columbia, where I got my PhD. And there was a day at Columbia where there were signs up around campus criticizing Brinkley from the left because he was too tough on Stalin. And he came to class that day and said, I never thought I would be attacked from the left, but yet, here we are. So, I mean, but, you know, we can argue about whether that's the left or not and all that. But so what we decided we would do, because it is 2024 and therefore 100 years since the death of Vladimir Lenin, let's talk about this very interesting figure. And one of the things I remember from your course was you referred to the, quote, good Lenin, bad Stalin myth, which I ran into a lot. There were the Workers' Vanguard communist newspaper, as you know, was sold on the streets of Cambridge. And that was their line, that 1917 was a glorious thing, and it was very unfortunately derailed by Stalin. So that'll be a little bit in the background of what we say. But so let me start with this. What do we need to know about Lenin's background? I mean, apart from his brother being executed by the regime, that would help us understand the man he later became.
Yes. Before we go into his background, what I'd like to say for any person who wants to understand anything about Lenin, one has to see that there are two Lenins. There is a public persona that was carefully crafted over the years, both in Russia and the Soviet Union at that time and abroad, and presented a very, very positive picture, which stayed, despite anything, to the present day, which is that Lenin is a revolutionary, that he's a leader of the proletariat, that he created socialism, that he's the founder of the Soviet Union. And then there is another Lenin, and Professor Pipes, my teacher at Harvard, and a colleague and a good friend, he wrote once an article called The Real Lenin. And it was only the beginning to try to find out what Lenin was like as a politician, the way he interacted with his party associates. And what was he like in his decisions affecting people's lives, such as during the Civil War? And then the final stage, Moshe Lewin wrote a book about Lenin's last struggle, which was the first step trying to understand how the system he set up functioned and where he himself thought he was wrong. In other words, Lenin is a very complex picture, but to the present day, the positive by far outweighs the negative. in his presentation. That's it. As for his background, he was a noble in the first generation, and his grandfather was a Kalmyk peasant. I mean, like a poor Asian in the lower parts of Volga. And then his father was already a supervisor of schools, so made tremendous upward mobility through education, and was a kind of a bourgeois family with nice tea parties and the teachers in their household. And he and his brother were typical for that generation. They were interested in revolution, interested in socialism, interested in new ideas, which at that time was Marxism. So they were quite typical for that time. Middle-class people by American terminology and rebel types, children who want to study the fashionable at that time ideas, as I said, of Marxism. So in that sense, he was just like so many others in his youth.
So as he becomes a theoretician, he diverges from classical Marxism in some central and historically critical ways.
Yes.
And I guess maybe the most essential of these is the idea of the vanguard of the proletariat, would you say?
Yes. This is what has been said many times by many scholars, is that Lenin was diverged from what really was Marxism into his own theory, but they still call it Marxism-Leninism. I'm quite different from others in my understanding of early Lenin. And by the way, my colleague Lars Lee, who was at Princeton together we were, he seriously takes Lenin's book, State and Revolution. He analyzes it and looks for meaning. And for people like Lars, I mean, Lenin is a democrat. He really, really thinks about creating workers' government and workers' state. I deny everything, and absolutely. He was never interested in workers, never was interested in democracy, never was interested in anything but seizing power. Lenin's preoccupation in those years to find a way to seize power. What I call him in one of my early lectures, I called him an SR spy in Marxist circles. SR are socialist revolutionaries. These are Russian populists who were at that time a terrorist party who believed, these were intelligentsia types, who believed that they had their roots in the great Russian people, the peasants. So they idealized the peasants and practiced terrorism by killing Tsarist officials. Lenin said, no, we're not going to do it this way. We're going to use the workers. That's the key word. Use the workers to create the revolution, not just terrorism. Kill one czar, like he said in one of his speeches. There was Alexander II, now it'll be Alexander III. So my understanding of Lenin, he found a different way by using Marxism and using the workers as a method to seize power and create society from the bottom up. And then I argue in my early articles is that in itself is totally un-Marxist. In other words, Lenin proves by his actions that he's not a Marxist, because Marxists believe in stages of history. Capitalism follows feudalism, socialism follows capitalism. If you believe that you can seize power and change the society from the top down, there's no way this is Marxist. It's not Marxist. So I argue Lenin proved that Marx was wrong, because Lenin did seize power and did change society from the top down. And in that sense, he's anything but Marxist.
Given that the Bolsheviks were an extremely tiny minority, do you think it is too provocative, or do you think it is maybe conceptually helpful to think of the Bolshevik Revolution as some kind of a conspiracy?
Well, no, it was not a conspiracy, because this was the time when all political parties were exploding. This was the time when the Tsar collapsed, Tsarism collapsed, and anybody could do anything. So this is the figures that I cite in my previous book on the political parties and social movements in the Russian Civil War. At the beginning of 1917, just imagine, there were 25,000 Bolsheviks, 25,000 in a country of 150 million. So this was nothing. It was just a tiny circle of intellectuals. There were about 50,000 Mensheviks, and there were about 100,000 SRs, socialist revolutionaries, because they had the intelligentsia all over Russia in the provinces. So by the end of 1917, there was 1 million SRs, 250,000 Bolsheviks, and 200,000 Mensheviks, which means every political party just exploded. But, and here's what I argue in my reasoning, the SRs, a lot of them were rural intelligentsia and kind of educated, literate peasants. And the Mensheviks, there were many workers, actual real workers who were mostly skilled. If you look at the membership of the Bolshevik Party, these were angry soldiers who were tired of World War I. And the only thing they understood by the word Bolshevism is stop the war now, as the slogan was bayonets into the ground and go home. So their Bolshevism was very, very superficial. They just didn't want the war to go on, and they would support any party that promised immediate peace. This was one of the great reasons why the Bolsheviks seized power. When people supported the Bolsheviks in 1917, it was not to establish dictatorship of the proletariat, not to create some kind of workers' socialism. It was one, overwhelmingly one purpose only: stop the war now.
Then also, now again, this is a little bit fuzzy for me because it has been some time, although I did read the relevant portion of your book. But as I recall, the Bolsheviks were accusing, because remember, of course, the Bolsheviks are not overthrowing the Tsar. There was another regime in power. And yes, they were accusing the Kerensky regime of having no intention of actually convening this so-called Constituent Assembly, which then, as I recall, the Bolsheviks convened it once, and then that was the end of it.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, you remember right. It is actually in the Mensheviks After October that I go day by day and the events that followed the seizure of power. And in fact, the Bolshevik first government was called the Provisional Government of Workers and Peasants until the convocation of the Constituent Assembly. This was the reason that they supposedly seized power in the Congress of Soviets in order to assure the convocation of the Constituent Assembly, because supposedly the bourgeois parties were sabotaging it. This was the line they took in October and November. So indeed, as soon that they seized power, promising to convene the Constituent Assembly, and I think they hoped that they would somehow get the majority. And then when the Constituent Assembly assembled, this was the first and real free elections in Russia. There are books written about how they were convened and who participated all over Russia. Oliver Rathke wrote the book about it. Anyway, it was free and fair elections, and the clear winner were the socialist revolutionaries, 40% of the vote, which is a peasant party. And that is the way it's supposed to be. Russia was a peasant country. The peasants were the majority of the population. And the SRs had established themselves for many decades as the people who went to the villages to help the peasants to get better life. So it's obvious that they had a majority. Well, Lenin said, nah, who cares? We're going to establish dictatorship of the proletariat, which means their own dictatorship. And that's not me who's saying it. The first person who said it was Rosa Luxemburg, and following him, Julius Martov, Russian Menshevik. They were the ones first to say, hey, wait a second, that's not a workers' dictatorship. This is a dictatorship of the Communist Party.
You say that people were eager to get out of the war, and so was Lenin. And this helps to account for more than any other reason why people might have supported him. But was the public prepared for the kinds of territorial concessions that Lenin was going to make?
No, absolutely not. It's one thing to say we are against the war, but it's quite another thing when the Germans are advancing and there's no clearly defined territory. I mean, the borders of Ukraine, this is an interesting thing, were not defined. Actually, as they're now, not quite defined, just the West defined them. But in terms of Russians, they don't know where the Russia ends and where Ukraine begins. So the Germans said Ukraine is going to be independent, but the borders were never defined. And they kept on advancing. And in the end, they took Rostov-on-Don, which by any definition is not Ukraine. Even in the wildest interpretation of Ukrainian borders, Rostov-on-Don is Russia. Yet they already occupied it because it supposedly was Ukraine. So yes, there was tremendous opposition to this kind of a surrender that Trotsky performed at signing without looking at what he's signing as a protest. And all political parties were in favor of continuing the fight. The problem was that there was no army to fight. the army disappeared. The peasants took the rifles and went home. And in that sense, they could not really sustain any opposition to the Germans. The Germans could have advanced however much they wanted to, but they couldn't advance any further because they had a Western Front on their hands and they had American troops arriving in the spring of 1918. So they simply stopped because they took whatever they thought they could and they stopped the advance. Yes.
Now, sometimes I would hear that the dictatorial style, let's say, by which Lenin governed, was dictated not so much because that was his preference, but because he was surrounded by enemies, internal enemies, and it was a crisis, and what do you expect? What's the response to that?
Yeah, that really, we're close to the key of it. One thing, if we continue on 1918, which is partly in my book, The Mensheviks After October, what happened was that Lenin was very quickly losing the support of people that was there for the ending of the war. Because the war ended, that's it. The peasants go home. The workers want jobs. There are no jobs. The industry is ruined. And the peasants, once they get home, they stop being Bolsheviks. They become peasants. So what do peasants want? The peasants want to sow and sell. They want to sow grain and sell it. And this is where Lenin says, no. You're not going to be able to sell anything because we're going to have state controls over food production. And that's the beginning of a great civil war between the Bolsheviks and the peasants, which of course goes on for many years, for 1918, 1919, 1930. Now, the key argument that I make in the book on the Civil War is that the only reason the whites were able to mount a serious challenge to the Bolsheviks, the only reason was because they were moving into territories that were already in uprising against the Bolshevik rule, peasant territories. In other words, peasant rebellions cleared the way for the whites. And the whites came in and occupied the territories. They were good organizers, good army men, good administrators. And that's why they managed to challenge Lenin. To put it another way, if there hadn't been peasant rebellions, and there wouldn't have been any if Lenin didn't come up with his crazy policy of grain requisitioning, then his enemies would have been much weaker than they actually turned out to be. It was his doing, it was his policy that produced all these enemies.
Could you explain, just for people who might not know about the Russian Civil War, who the whites were? It's a very broad term that seems to be applied to numerous kinds of people.
Yes. Very good point. The whites were Russian officers from the Imperial Army. That's pretty much all they were. There was nobody else, pretty much. They were officers who basically felt that their duty was to defend Mother Russia. Not so much for the Tsar. Many of them were Republicans, but they were absolutely patriotic and against the communists and the Bolsheviks. And not so much because they opposed some worker policy or some capitalism or socialism. No, they basically wanted Great Russia. And from their point of view, the Bolsheviks ruined it. And therefore, they had to be opposed for the, as they called it, great and indivisible Russia. So they were patriots. Now, it wouldn't be unfair to call them fascists or anything like this. They were tough. When they fought, there was a lot of cruelty on both sides. But their ideology really was not what you would call in European context right wing or like Latin America or nothing like that. They were, now they're quite popular in Russia and there's a lot of interest in them and things are coming back. But they were definitely great officers organizing an army. And to give you an example, 150,000 army of General Denikin managed to mount an offensive out of nothing and advance to Moscow in the summer of 1919, coming to 200 kilometers close to it and then collapsed. But I write in the book that there were British correspondents who came to Denikin to congratulate him and cover his triumphal entry into Moscow. That could have happened, but it didn't.
Well, I recall the Greens are the peasants. I recall distinctly you in class saying the real civil war was with the Greens.
And absolutely.
From that point on, anytime I would read anything about the Russian Civil War that didn't even mention the Greens, I would think, this doesn't understand it at
absolutely.
All.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was the first one, I must credit myself, with discovering the enormity of the Green Rebellion. I think it's so incredible that for so many decades, this fundamental fact about the Russian Revolution and the Russian Civil War was not known. After me, it was Orlando Figes who wrote a great book about the peasant rebellion in the Volga region. And then there were several other books written on Tambov Rebellion. But what I am saying and have said already in the Civil War book, that the peasant rebel armies were 4, 5, 6 times bigger than the white armies combined. The number of peasant rebels in 1919 was in the hundreds of thousands. Andrea Graziosi, my good friend and colleague, Italian historian, he counted 2 million Russian peasants' rebellion from 1918 to 1921. Some historians give even a larger figure. People ask why they didn't win then. And the answer is very simple, because they're peasants. Peasants means they are not interested in creating some kind of administration. They are not interested in state power. They're not interested in taking Moscow. A good example would be like Mexican Zapatistas. They were not interested in taking Mexico City. They were interested in their own provinces. That's the nature of a peasant rebellion. And they wanted just to get out of the communists and the commissars, kill them off, and live their own lives with their own families and churches the way they want to. And it is only when they actually won that made Russia ungovernable, that Lenin agreed to what he called a retreat, which is a new economic policy, NEP. So I explained it that it was a victory of the peasant rebellions that forced the Bolsheviks to abandon their confiscations and abolition of money and all these other crazy experiments and allow peasants to do a normal life, buy, sell, have their shops, have their land, have their normal activity. And that, in a sense, you know, great proof that Lenin failed. Lenin failed because he had to admit that his policy was wrong and one had to retreat. If he refused to retreat, the Bolshevik authority, the Bolshevik system would have fallen within a year or two because it was unsustainable. He was smart enough to understand that you have to let go and abandon this idiocy called communism and go to normal life. And that's what happened in the 1920s.
Hey, everybody, a quick message from our sponsor, Crowd Health. If there's somebody out there who doesn't find American health insurance frustrating and expensive, I'd like to meet that person. Not to mention claims denials are becoming more common. Last year, 1 in 5 Obamacare claims were denied. And can I take a wild guess that the Affordable Care Act hasn't actually made your care more affordable? Well, that's why CrowdHealth was created. It's not health insurance. It's a better way to pay for health care through crowdfunding. Because let's face it, your insurance policy is opaque and full of unpleasant surprises, and your premiums are going up every year. You wind up feeling taken advantage of. Well, CrowdHealth is doing things differently. For $175 for an individual or $575 for a family of 4 or more, you'll get access to a community of people who are willing to help out in the event of an emergency. You'll get access to telemedicine visits, discounted prescriptions, and so much more, and without doctors' networks getting in the way. And I discovered at my last mastermind event that some of my most successful followers are using CrowdHealth. One CrowdHealth user at my mastermind told another CrowdHealth user at my mastermind, quote, "My wife's hip replacement surgery was $500 and that was it." Well, let CrowdHealth help with your healthcare needs. Get started today for just $99 per month for your first 3 months. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/woods. CrowdHealth is not insurance. Learn more at joincrowdhealth.com/woods. That's joincrowdhealth.com/woods. So before the new economic policy, before 1921, in the aftermath of the Bolshevik Revolution, if I were somebody living in the cities or in the countryside, how is my life as an ordinary Russian noticeably different now? For example, religiously.
Religiously, there was an assault on the churches, but it was not as serious as it was in 1921-22. But the life in the cities was fundamentally different. I describe it too in one of my pieces, is that already 1 month after the Bolsheviks took power, 1 month, well-dressed people disappeared, just disappeared. There was no trade anymore. Markets disappeared. Shops disappeared. Banks were robbed. essentially the so-called nationalization was the Bolshevik gangs would seize the banks and divide up the money. There was no police. There were gangs of people who would burst into bourgeois apartments, kill the men, rape the women, take all the valuables, and consider it that the proletarians have divided up the wealth of the bourgeoisie. This was called the Loot the Looters campaign. Then there was another campaign of using bourgeois apartments for the proletarians, which means you could kick out the rich people and move in yourself and call yourself a proletarian. So it was really free for all. It was lawlessness that is a state policy. To abuse rich people became a normal practice. It was very hard time for if you're a lawyer or an engineer or anybody who is dressed in a normal European way, the way we're dressed now, you're in trouble. The best thing to survive is to try to dress as a peasant, hide all the valuables you have, sell them one at a time, and the best thing is just leave Petrograd or Moscow and go out to the south where there still are Cossacks and the whites where you could still survive. And that's many, many Russians did that.
There was famine during these years, and the question is, was the famine caused by war conditions, the civil war, or was it caused by stupid economic policy?
Both. The war, of course, propelled stupid economic policy of confiscations, and the confiscations propelled the civil war. But of course, in the cities, the situation was getting worse and worse and worse all the time. And again, as I write in the Mensheviks After October, that is why the workers began going on strike. And I call it the Menshevik political comeback, because the Mensheviks are saying to the workers, you see, the Bolshevik experiments have led you to unemployment. We need the owners. We need the cooperation between the private sector and the workers so that the factories could work. So life of middle-class people was consistently getting worse and worse and worse. I published some of the letters of the Mensheviks that Martov describes beautifully, the everyday conditions in Moscow in 1918-1919, where the international folks, French and British and other, they lived in a national hotel and they had all these nice luxuries and good food and restaurants and things. And then, of course, the poor proletarians barely had anything to eat. So it was quite a exchange of positions. Who was nothing became everything, and who was everything became nothing. That's the saying of those years.
You know, when I think about the French Revolutionary Reign of Terror, that was carried out with the justification that the regime was surrounded by enemies and traitors. But the way it was carried out was far more gruesome than would have been necessary to handle that alleged problem. And it looks like the same is true of the Red Terror under Lenin. What did that look like?
Yeah, the Red Terror is, again, a special period. Nobody could have foreseen it. And I guess even Lenin didn't know that it would get to this point. It was kind of growing one thing at a time. At first, it was just smashing the bourgeoisie and the bankers and the capitalists and robbing them. They were not particularly dangerous. The official Red Terror began in 1st of September 1918 when attempt was made of assassination of Lenin. But many people actually say that the terror started a little earlier, which is summer 1918 with the murder of the Tsar. And the reason that they killed the Tsar is because they were afraid that what they call the whites, but at that time they were not the whites, they were socialists, SRs. They raised a rebellion in the Urals and Siberia, and they were getting close to Yekaterinburg, where the Tsar was. And so they thought it would be safer to kill him and then blame it on the locals. Now we know it's proven beyond any doubt that it was Lenin's orders that the Tsar was killed. And after that, it was panic. And I always say, even it's true today, terror is the weapon of the weak, not of the strong. When they're weak, then they resort to killing because that's the only resort they have. And so in the summer of 1918, the Bolsheviks were in terrible, terrible condition. The SR rebellion, the British were helping Admiral Kolchak in the east of the country, and they were advancing, and the Germans were still there, and there were wonderful letters of Count Mirbach, who is the German ambassador, who described the situation in his letters day by day in what was going on in Moscow. And he was saying that his data showed that the Bolsheviks prepared foreign passports for themselves in case they had to leave the country, and they stole a lot of money from the Tsar and many others, and they were ready to go in case the situation with the uprising turned sour for them. So this is when they start Red Terror, which means Red Terror means executing people, as many as necessary, by category, not for individual guilt. That's the point. That's the difference, even from the French Revolution. The French Revolution had some kind of a court, you know, they were really flimsy courts, but at least there was some kind. Here, you don't need any court. You basically send in the detachment of Cheka, and then they seize people for not what they did, but what they potentially could do and who they are as such, which means Tsarist officers execute them, capitalists execute them, former policemen or people who worked for in the Tsarist administration execute them. And it just goes on by category more and more. And then they got to a point where there were some workers and there were some peasants and there were some socialists. Anybody who has potential any danger for the survival of the Bolshevik regime has to be destroyed. And that is when the Cheka just kept calling more and more and more victims. The worst times was probably 1919, 1920.
Well, if people associated with the Tsarist regime were targeted, what happened then to competing parties like the SRs and the Mensheviks?
Yeah, absolutely. The SRs were the first victims because they were the ones who raised the rebellion in the name of Constituent Assembly. And of course, if they were seized, they were executed. The Mensheviks were theoretically still legal opposition. They were never officially banned. So they were harassed. They would be arrested. They would be beaten up and then would be let go, at least in 1918, 1920. But increasingly, as they were witnesses to what the Bolsheviks were doing, and as witnesses, they had connections. They could send information to Martov in Moscow. Martov had all kinds of friends in the socialist circles in Europe, among social democrats in Germany, socialists in France, laborists in Britain. And they were very afraid that through Martov, the world would know what the dictatorship of the proletariat is really like. So increasingly, there were more and more Mensheviks and other socialists, leftist SARs among them, who were sent to the Gulag, essentially, to the camps in the north, the Solovki. So this was, again, I published, those of you who are interested, I have a book called Dear Comrades, Mensheviks Reports on the Russian Revolution and Civil War, who were Institution Press, where these are the documents. That's not me speaking. I selected and published letters of the Mensheviks from various parts of the country, including those who wound up in the Solovki camp in the north.
Let me see. There are a few things I want to make sure I get to here. So is it safe to say, is it reasonable to say that Lenin's attitude toward the peasants was that they existed for the sake of providing food for the city so he could build up a Russian industrial base? That was why they were there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. It was absolutely utilitarian. They were there to provide what they should provide, which is grain. And he could have actually gotten more grain if he was wise enough to do it by trade, by selling. We're kind of going a little forward, but I'll give you this example. There are calculations by economists that Stalin could have had four times more grain in 1932 for his industrialization if he had not gone for collectivization. In other words, you could get a lot of grain from the peasants. All you need to do is give them a good price. How do you give them a good price? Well, if you can't pay them in rubles, you can pay them in services. You could pay them with education, with roads, with all kinds of other things that they need. But the Bolsheviks were not even interested in discussing anything in terms of give and take. You do it because we're a dictatorship of the proletariat. If you don't, we'll shoot you. That's the kind of a military mentality that developed. And I want to say, since we're talking about Lenin, it's a little bit, the Bolshevik and Lenin is not quite the same. Because Lenin is very smart, and he gives orders, and the more down they go, the more ruthless and cruel they become, because the executors of these rules and orders are very primitive people, and they're ruffled by the war and by the poor education, by the background they came from. So in other words, the Bolshevik face of the down below at the master's level is much more detestable than Lenin. Lenin himself basically thought his job is to keep his power because that's, from his point of view, is objectively progressive, and to create a new system where the Communist Party would rule everything. And the Communist Party is good because it is his party, because they recruit people from the people, from the workers, and they will create a new society without any bourgeoisie or nobles or czar or any of this. This was kind of his vision of it. And that's why many people say, well, he meant good. They say, well, he wanted to create a better society. Well, maybe he did, but what he actually was creating was a very lopsided, very cruel, and very inefficient society that had very little, if anything, to do with anything that Marx or Engels had ever written.
So if he has a contemptuous attitude toward the peasantry, one might be tempted to conclude that he had a more friendly attitude toward the workers. But what was his relationship like with workers?
Yes, workers is very good. Workers had all kinds of privileges in the sense that they were proclaimed to be the ruling class. But the point is, they were proclaimed to be a ruling class as a class, but individually, workers had to obey. They had to obey their leaders, and their leaders were appointed ones. And if they didn't, they would be treated the same way as anybody else. I have a wonderful document that we have because of the British doctors and American doctors who were with General Graves in Siberia. And just before the Bolsheviks retreated from the Urals in December 1918, they retreated. And the British and the Americans came in January 1919, and they seized documents from a recent strike, which again, I published these documents in the Dear Comrades book. And it shows that 110 workers of the Motovilliha plant in the Urals were executed for a strike. They went on strike. Well, that's counter-revolution by definition, and they were shot. So Lenin's attitude to workers was, you have to work and obey and shut up because the party takes care of you. And if you don't, well, you will be proclaimed the counter-revolutionary. On the other hand, there were many workers who were recruited into the administration, into the local city councils, into, they had career opportunities. And many of my colleagues in America, just, they love it. They say, oh, see, this is upward mobility. This is a country where the workers raised from the workers' milieu and became administrators, became directors, became engineers. There were lots of educational opportunities. Yes, that's true. There were educational opportunities, but they could have been provided without terror. They could have been provided with an opportunity, like in any other normal country, for workers to go on strike and create their trade unions, as it is a norm in many normal countries in the West, in Western Europe, in the United States at that time. So Lenin's attitude to workers was utilitarian. We use them, and they have to be thankful. And if they're not, well, we'll check how we'll deal with them.
Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here with a message about my mastermind, which is set to begin its second year. And I'd like to know if you belong in that room with us. We have a member who's in corporate, but most of the people in the mastermind are running their own businesses. So maybe you're doing well, but you could be doing better. You want to bounce ideas off smart, successful people and get the kind of feedback that takes you and your business to the proverbial next level. Well, that's what the Tom Woods Mastermind is all about. We meet three times a year, each time in a different city. We dig deep into your business and give very specific, actionable advice. It's a small group, so we can give you lots of individual attention. Connections and partnerships also emerge. People are reporting great results. Two members just entered into a potentially multi-million dollar partnership. We've also become great friends, and I'm all for the work hard, play hard philosophy, so we enjoy great food and entertainment together, all of which is included in the package. We're not interested in growing by 5%. We're interested in moving everyone up to that proverbial next level where they, perhaps you, dream of being but can't quite get there on their own. Now, masterminds are not cheap. Price them for yourself and see, and they're not for everyone. But for the right person, they are life-changing. As Henry Bingaman, who's a member of the mastermind, puts it, sometimes you have to pay to be in the room. Almost every dollar of income in my copywriting career I can trace back to a handshake somewhere. Ready to open a new chapter? Head to woodsmastermind.com, click the button, and let's talk. I think we should say a word about Stalin and how he fits into this picture and what his relationship with Lenin was like, because I have a sense that later on, when Stalin is in charge, his relationship with Lenin and the fact that he could count himself among the original revolutionaries helped to build up his own mystique among the public. And I also recall a number of people saying that, well, Lenin toward the end started to see where Stalin might go, and he had regrets about this and warned about him. What's the real truth about that relationship?
It's a very difficult topic because Stalin changed over time too. Stalin of 1923 is not Stalin of 1933 and of course 1937. So it's very difficult to kind of make one easy definition of what Stalin is and his relationship. But we can go like this. Stalin was a very, very careful apparatchik. And that means that he was really good at intrigues and politics, not in the sense of appealing to the millions of people as Trotsky was or as Lenin was. He was really good about games within an institution. So the institution is the Communist Party. Communist Party has nothing to do with communism. Communist Party should be understood as a network of government officials, administrators, Soviets, which means city councils, provincial councils, ministries where they run in the street, collect food, distribute food, collect this, distribute that. In other words, it's a government network. And he was very, very good about appointing who goes here, who goes there. And in fact, this is the key reason why he won over Trotsky, because Trotsky was not interested in this apparatchik games. He was interested in defining state policy, defining the course of the revolution, talking to the millions of people in meetings and assemblies. He's a kind of a orator. Stalin is the opposite. He's not interested. He doesn't know how to talk. He talks poorly with a terrible Georgian accent. He never talks. He's just mostly silent, but he's scheming and plotting. And step by step, he's replacing people who are not loyal to him and replacing them, those who are loyal to him personally. He's building up a clan. And that's what he's coming from the Caucasus. That's his tradition. You built up a clan, because everybody should be supported to you and bow to you and accept you. This is, you know, the way it is in the mafia or the way it is in the villages. And so that's what he's doing for 7 years. And in 1923, Lenin is sick. Lenin is dying. Once in a while, he comes back to life and he sees what's going on and that the party is out of control. This is what Moshe Nuin writes in his book, Lenin's Last Struggle. He realized he's in shock. He doesn't know what to do. His monster is no longer obeying him. And he realizes this is a monster because it has too much power and the procedures are not defined. There's no checks and balances. He should have read Montesquieu. There are no checks and balances. So he comes up with these articles that everybody's so fascinating. One of his last articles was, how can we reorganize Rabkrin, which means workers and peasants inspection. So he thought that we should have a kind of counterweight that the workers and peasants inspection should be inspecting other institutions of government so that there's some kind of counterweight. Well, Stalin showed him how easy it is to correct. He staffed the workers and peasants inspection with people loyal to him, and they would inspect that which he showed to inspect and not to inspect what is not to be inspected, and that was it. So the kind of a pyramid of power was already built by Lenin, and Stalin just took it over. Lenin created the foundations of a one-party centralized dictatorship. Stalin just took it over. and then eliminated all the competition at the top. Especially it was easy because these people were journalists. I mean, their background, Kamenev, Zinoviev, Trotsky, they were journalists and speakers and orators. They liked to deal with other socialists in the cafes. I just came back from Vienna and I was in the Café Central where Trotsky was drinking coffee and talking about the revolution. That's what they knew how to do, but they didn't know how to appoint, you know, people who would execute policy. And that's what Stalin was a genius. He was truly spectacular organizer and administrator. But he had other problems. He was paranoid about fear. He had no vision for the future. His strategic thinking was zero. I mean, terrible, especially that would show during the Second World War. But he was a great, great administrator, and he outplayed them all. And speaking of Lenin, Lenin realized, it was smart enough, he realized it, but it was too late. However, I should say this, it was not really too late, because NEP Russia, as my teacher Stephen Cohen showed, had a great potential. And here I should say something that many of you listeners might appreciate to listen to hear, is that Deng Xiaoping studied in Russia in 1924-25, and he loved it. And I read some of his memoirs. He loved it. In fact, one could say that Deng Xiaoping, when he came to power in China in the mid-70s, implemented what he thought is the best system, which means capitalism in economy and political control by the Communist Party. That is what he discovered in the prosperous and booming 1924-25 Russia, where the Communist Party was in power, but one could ride a Ford car and one could own a shop and the factory, and when everything was moving just fine before Stalin's second revolution. So Deng Xiaoping is a good student of Lenin, Lenin of a type that created NEP, the new economic policy of the 1920s.
Let's wrap up with this. Here we are 100 years later, and we can listen to everything that we've just said and simply conclude that Lenin was a bad person and leave it at that. But are there, I hate to say lessons of history, but maybe more broadly applicable conclusions or warnings we might arrive at by studying the life of Lenin?
Yes, you see, as I said, Lenin is a very complex picture. What I see is not the way many other people see it, because what I see is a kind of from a Russian perspective. For those people who care about Russia, as I do, Lenin was a disaster. Lenin was a catastrophe. In fact, my last book, which I published in Russia, in Russian, is called The Great October Catastrophe. Mm. It was a catastrophe in terms of the society that was primitivized and depopulated and 10 million people wasted for nothing. In terms of the economic impact, about social impact, cultural impact, it was really, really bad. Lenin's rule was a catastrophe for Russia. But that's just from the Russian perspective. But if you look at Lenin, as when I studied in Germany, I had many, many students who were my classmates. They loved Lenin. I mean, for them, Lenin was the guy who stopped the war. Lenin was the guy who was champion of workers' rights, who was against capitalist exploitation. And I hear the same today. When I have comments to my YouTube channel, a lot of people write to me from what we call the Third World or from the Global South. They love Lenin because they think he was against imperialism. He was against exploitation. He was for workers' rights. He created the idea of a socialism. In other words, from that kind of view, he was a successful revolutionary that implemented the power of the workers. Now, I'm telling them it wasn't really the power of the workers, and it was terrible. I said, yeah. But for them, he's a hero in a sense that he challenged capitalism and challenged imperialism. So these are the kinds of different ways of looking at Comrade Lenin.
Well, I want to, first of all, I'm going to do two things in the description of the video, but also at tomwoods.com/2479. I'm going to link to your YouTube channel, which says that's how I found you after all these years. I saw one of your videos and I said, doggone it, that's my professor. So that was how I got in touch with you, through your publisher. But I will also link to this book, which we've talked about a small portion of it, but From Vladimir Lenin to Vladimir Putin, Russia in Search of Its Identity, 1913 to 2023. Very interesting. You're going to love Dr. Brofkin's point of view. It's rich with interesting detail that just jumps off the page. This is not like reading the phone book. For those of you who remember phone books, this is a very, very compelling book that I highly recommend. So Dr. Brofkin, I hope we can do this again sometime soon and talk about other topics in Russian history.
Yes, I'd like to say that I certainly would like to continue this conversation, because one of the most interesting parts is the connection between Lenin and Putin, something that was left, but it's something to discuss, because there are some interesting parallels and some interesting views. Like Putin himself spoke of Lenin, and it's fascinating to see how he perceives Lenin as a leader of Russia and how that changes over time. So this is one of the topics to consider.
Oh, let's do that. I've never seen anyone do that, so therefore we have to do it. I'll get in touch with you and let's make that happen.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you so much again for your time today, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.